This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and we're back with a news episode, and not just any news episode, because Dave, and I do say Dave, is going to predict the future today. He's going to tell you all the good things are going to happen next year, aren't you?
Well, I think we're going to talk about someone else's predictions, and I think some of it we're going to laugh, and some of it we're going to cry, and some of it we're just going to go, huh? But there we go.
But in the end, it's still Dave's fault, right? It's not on me. This is your article. You found this article, so it's all on you.
Fair enough.
Just throwing you under the bus here. No problem.
No pressure. All right. Well, in that case, let's just get straight into it. So found this this article on Tech Republic from Jack Wallen. We've covered a number of his articles through the years. And with this one, he's making some rather bold prognostications and as to what he believes will be a banner year for open source in 2021.
Yeah, specifically Linux, right? It says so here, Linux. I do like the little Lego minifig here. He doesn't look very calm.
Like, he is not looking calm and collected, and he does not look like all his headaches have been answered. So, yeah.
Anyway, let's go down.
Yeah.
And we're just going to go over the topics here. We're not going in depth on the whole article and just, I mean, to be honest, it's hard to predict stuff with everything's going on in the world. Any prediction you're going to make is going to be outdated by next week, I think. So it's very brave of this person to do this. Let's get that out of. And we'll just take the topics and pretty much start talking around them, I guess.
Yep.
So number one, Kubernetes simplified.
So for those that are thinking, what's this Kubernetes thing? All like two of you have just emerged from underneath your rocks. Or from out of your caves, you can go ahead and listen to our entire episode on the history of Kubernetes and microservices. But for those of you that are fully up to speed and listen to our glorious drivel on that, you will have seen a continual sort of path through that journey, which is people attempting to try and make things simpler throughout. And trying to, like, some new exciting technology gets deployed or designed or developed, and dear God, it's difficult to work with, and how do we make this easier for the masses, and all these kind of things. And Kubernetes is no different in that respect. And Jack's comments are really that he believes that there will be a web or client-based tool that will make Kubernetes management a true point-and-click affair.
I hope not, because it's supposed to be auto-healing and auto-generating without me clicking on stuff.
I think that there's different kind of pieces of this. I think you could make the argument that in that case the future is already here. You just need to go to a cloud provider, like. Go into bigger.
Or use Rancher.
I think there's. So, quite whether he's saying. Whether he's saying, like, that simplified experience, that kind of initial bootstrapping, but for people that want to run their own, or whether he's saying that the ability to run this, you know, in the cloud is going to get even simpler. I don't know.
For me, I mean, we talked about this when we did the saga on earlier episodes during the KubeCon era. And I think I kind of made a statement there as well that the technological innovations in Kubernetes were probably going to be taking a little bit of a backseat in favor of making what they have more user-friendly, and specifically around integration with infrastructure. Because at the moment, it's fairly easy to bootstrap a Kubernetes environment and have containers spinning on your cluster. That takes you a couple of hours at most, read a couple of books, a couple of web pages, and you're up and running. So going from there to a point and click affair for that part, that's whatever.
Yeah.
The thing is, when you get into actual deployments, when you have to think about persistent storage claims, because my cluster has stateful compute to data connections, and if a container gets restarted, it should kind of reattach itself to the original data blob. Now you're getting to stuff that's harder to do. And also, of course, I want my Active Directory or LDAP hierarchy automatically integrated in the secrets database of Kubernetes. Ooh, now it gets harder again. And then you start putting in the layered applications. I want these applications, I want Kubernetes to be application aware to the operator stuff, and it gets harder. And that's where the complexity comes from. And getting that into a web-based point-and-click affair is something, one, I don't want. I want my monitoring to be a point-and-click web affair, and that's already here. Mm-hmm. That's totally the way you do it these days. Yeah. But deploying, maintaining this stuff, you're so close to the infrastructure layer. Even the managed services or the clouds, they'll get you that first step as a point-and-click to get you the environment to deploy your stuff. But then, inevitably, CLI is going to be king for a long time to come. And has a lot of room to get simplified.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying it won't get simpler. I'm just saying that point and click is not always simpler, to be honest. And we actually have another article to talk about that.
Indeed, indeed. But before we get to that, moving on, I think this is probably his safest and softest bet, which is proprietary solutions get the boot.
You first.
So in my opinion, I've been at a variety of open source organizations through a variety of interesting, financial global crises of varying magnitudes over the years. I think I've probably told this story on the podcast before, but I was at Red Hat during, what at the time had been the largest kind of global financial recession to date, during kind of, the sort of 2008-2009 period. And within, a year or two of that, Red Hat became within 2 years of that, Red Hat became the first $1 billion open source organization. The financial crisis actually accelerated Red Hat's growth, and this was during the time when it was Unix to Linux migrations were still a thing. This was the time when the large proprietary middleware platforms were being torn out and replaced by JBoss open source, and things like that were happening across every industry vertical, every size of business, small, medium, and large. And I've been through a number of differing scales of crises both before and since then. And open source solutions typically do very well during, cases of crisis. It's just budgets shrink. People can't just carry on doing the same thing that they've always been doing. It's just not possible anymore. And so something's got to give, something's got to change. And it's not about going for a cheaper solution as such. It's about trying to deliver the same, you have to make a change. It's kind of funny enough, it's a similar sort of situation that we were talking about with our previous news episode, which is there's a catalyst, there's a compelling event, there's something happening that you just can't, you can't carry on doing what you're doing. You need to make a change. And in a lot of cases, open source ends up being that change. And they don't just replace like for like, but they, significantly improve their situation from where they were beforehand. So yeah, I think this will definitely hold true for a lot of people and a lot of organizations.
Yeah, I think you're right that shifting to open source for monetary reasons is always a bad choice. It shouldn't be the prime. It should be a nice
bonus,
added little bonus. Yeah. But the main advantage for open source is the fact that it's built in a distributed manner and it integrates a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And that has, apart from being potentially cheaper, the added effect that you get away from the monoliths.
Yep.
Instead of when you do the next 5-year plan and we're going to replace our Oracle by SAP, which means multi-billion dollar investment and everything goes away and gets replaced. Open source mentality, the whole idea behind it, allows you to just pick little pieces of the environment of applications you have, and you shouldn't have too many either. Try to keep it simple, yeah. But still, it's a microservices organization at that point, and you can just upgrade the things where it makes sense without having to do the forklift upgrade of everything at the same time, which is hugely expensive. And by the time it's finished, you're already beginning the next one. And by doing it more iteratively, more point solutiony, it's that makes the biggest difference for open source, I think. Now, the thing I disagree with him is I don't think this is a prediction. I think proprietary solutions have been given the boot more or less already. There's still a lot of stragglers out there. I can agree to that one. But I don't think this is a new movement.
Oh, yeah.
I think this has been going on for multiple years. And I'm actually expecting the curve to kind of stagnate. We've got the exponential adoption, let's say. And it's going to flatten out now because most of the long-hanging fruit has long been picked. The slow adopters are now doing it also, and now it's just, I'd say, the stragglers that are still need to go through it or don't have a chance, don't have the choice to do it. I mean, some people need propriety, I guess.
I don't know that I... So maybe very, very long term. Like, so first of all, I agree with the first part you said that, yes, this is... You're absolutely right in the fact that this is not really a prediction. That's why I said it was the softest possible one, because you're absolutely right. Like, this proprietary solution migration has been going up. Well, I talked about my experiences many, many years ago, and that wasn't even the start of the journey. But yes, that you're right. That's absolutely the case. And he's just predicting the next uptick of that, which I agree with for all the reasons we've both just talked about. Now, the question of whether or not this will eventually slow down, I think, yes, you're probably right. There will be an eventual, like, rounding off of the curve, but I think we're a long way away from that at the moment. Like, if I think about the way that open source has, you know, evolved in the enterprise space, you know, it started off with your OS, and then it was your application platforms, and then it was your virtualization platforms, and then it was it started to just, like, spread everywhere. Like, everything potentially within an enterprise could be open source. You know, there was almost no limit to it, but the limits have continued to grow and develop. Mm-hmm. Like, we've seen, you know, big data platforms and all sorts of things that, you know, have primarily driven, I would say, by open source in a lot of situations. In machine learning, artificial intelligence, so much of that is open source. I guess, yeah, maybe I'm talking myself round to your point of view, but I think what I was thinking initially was that I think the boundaries keep moving and expanding out, and that there is more and more that open source can do. And therefore, there's no limit to it. But I think as I talk through this and as I rubber duck this whole kind of conversation, I think what I'm actually coming around to is, like, it's not that open source will level off in terms of the proprietary systems that it will replace. It's actually that proprietary will just kind of continue to descend and descend. Like, potentially, will there be any proprietary solutions in the distant future? Will everything be open source? Probably not. No. Probably not. But
there's always going to be some reason that it needs to be proprietary, because, I mean, could you imagine a Tesla car running on open source stuff that you can download from GitHub? That needs to go through that many regulatory stuff. I mean, it can be based on open source, but there will always be a proprietary part there just because they need the stamp of approvals from you're allowed to drive this thing.
Yeah. So I think I've come around.
It's never going to be all.
Yeah,
it's never... a logarithmic curve.
Yeah.
It's infinity will get flat. So yeah. It'll never be totally flat because it'll always up a little bit. But I think we definitely, if you have the logarithmic curve in view, we're over the hump, let's
yeah,
say.
Yeah.
We're not, this is established now. This is what's going to happen. Everybody knows it. It's just waiting when your turn is to join the great new reality, the free haven of open source.
Indeed.
Wow. Well, we had John Murdoch on a couple of months ago, so it's still, the glow is still here.
All right. Well,
hi, John.
Let's shift from proprietary solutions getting the boot to fog computing. Tell us.
That was a new one for me.
Oh, good. I'm glad it's not just you. I read this and I was like, really? Fog computing?
I do get it.
And it is actually a term, though. I think about it. I have seen before. But it's definitely not prevalent yet. Like it's probably the next. Oh God, it's probably the next hype wave, isn't it? Fog computing.
Oh, probably.
Oh God.
Although it doesn't have a good ring to it, it doesn't sound like money. So
no. I think some more branding exercises are needed here.
But the whole thing about the fog is it's the combination of the edge computing, which at a point was hype. Everything's got to go to the edge. And then he kind of figured out that it doesn't really work that way. So we can't really pull it back to the central data center. So let's do it in the middle somewhere. And now we're in this kind of morass of fogginess, I guess. I don't think that's the end of it yet. So now his prediction is that fog computing will be a big buzzword. And I can agree to that. It has to come, fog or whatever the name becomes, the concept will be a buzz thing next year. I wouldn't be surprised of that because a couple of big cloud providers are starting to talk that way as well. But it's not something that's really defined yet because you have the edge, you have your central location, and you have all the space in between. Where is the sweet spot? There isn't one. Depending on the use case, you're going to be there, even there or there.
Mm.
And basically, and by the way, if you're listening to the MP3 here, you didn't see my magical hand waving for that.
Makes for great radio.
But yeah, I mean, if it replaces that blockchain thing, I guess I'll be happy. I don't know.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next prediction, which is big data.
I thought that was the softest one.
Well... I don't know because I think of a soft one as being like that. Of course, that's going to happen. Like, don't be daft. Whereas this one's just weak, which is different. Anyway, big data gets even bigger. Yes, I guess. I can absolutely. Big data has just become data now. Yes, it's technically big, but for the most part, most organizations are just like, yeah, it's just data now. Yes, it's big, but we don't really think about it. It's just like we've got a way of dealing with it, and we get on with it. So there's less mysticism around the world of big data than it was 5 years ago when we started this.
Let me skew this a little bit then.
Go for it.
The number of V's in big data will ever increase.
Yes, there we go. I think did you? So yes. I did a short podcast.
You cheated on me.
I did for a partner organization, and the host asked me some questions about the world of big data, and it was funny because I knew the question was coming. And so I'd done a little bit of a refresh and a bit of poking around, and I found, I don't remember what the number was, but there was like the 8 or 9 V's of big data, I think. And it's like, oh God, it really, and it's not like any of them were a stretch. Like they were all perfectly like feasible and reasonable things to.
Let's call them elastic. They were stretchy. They were a bit. I mean, the later ones, I could feel the marketing in them very hard. I'm not going to repeat them because I don't want to spread the V's.
Yes, yes. So I think that is true. I think there will always be more V's to add. What I struggle with on this is the part of his prediction is that SUSE will be at the head of this big data acceleration. Because they adopted Rancher Labs, and I don't want to I don't want to disparage Rancher Labs. I think they've done like some amazing work, but I don't. I mean, yes, Egon is highlighting, and for those of you that are following along, he's highlighting the fact that SUSE is the de facto standard for SAP HANA rollouts. Like so, I mean, again, I don't want to disparage those that love SAP HANA, but. You know, yes, it's out there. Yes, there's lots of people using it, but it's not all consuming. Like if you asked how many people in the big data space are using SAP HANA as part of that ecosystem, I'm willing to bet it's what, less than 10%, I think is a fairly safe bet.
No idea.
Probably even lower than that. Just from the organizations I've talked to over the years, and yes, I've talked to organizations that are using it, but I've talked to significantly more organizations that are not using it and have no interest in it. So, and like Rancher Labs,
Rancher isn't a big data thing. It's a big compute thing. It's a container platform, orchestration, abstraction layer. Not sure how to pronounce it these days. It's got nothing to do with it. I mean, this actually made me look up the person because I didn't know the person to see if he was working for SUSE, if this was kind of some hidden marketing ploy of him, but I couldn't really find that. So I'm not
No.
sure if he is working for SUSE or not. But yeah, it was a bit okay, I
Yeah,
guess. So I mean, it's a bold prediction.
it is a bold prediction. I think it's so if we talked about soft predictions, we talked about weak predictions. I think this is a weird prediction. Like I can't join the dots on this one. Anyway, let's move on. And this is the inter well, I mean these next two really are both like entertaining,
That's
heartbreaking,
bold. That's bold.
like all of the above. I think surely we can just encapsulate both of these things together. So the first one is Linux begins enterprise desktop rollouts. And the second one is Linux on the home desktop will start to gain serious traction. Yes, ladies and
Serious traction,
let's
right?
let's
Serious traction.
let's ladies and gentlemen, 2021, year of the Linux desktop. I've just called
Again.
it, and therefore it will never happen. Oh dear. I think there are lots of interesting things happening around this. If you look at things like Steam supporting Linux now, quote unquote supporting, depending on your view of the world, and game compatibility, be it on Linux via things like Steam and the technologies that they plug in to allow you to run games like that, is a thing. Like it definitely is a movement. Like it wasn't done for altruistic reasons, though. It was done because they want to make sure that they can run things as efficiently as possible in things like a cloud streaming platform, for example. And that like it running on a Linux desktop is a byproduct. So don't get confused with what's happening here. It's not that they're expecting a huge number of Linux desktop users to suddenly, go head on into Steam and be the dominant purchasing player. But there is a
There's also a big difference between it can be done and it's a huge mass adoption of the potential of it can be done. And that's where it breaks down for me.
And I love Linux on the desktop. I've been using Linux on the desktop for a very, very long time. I still am today. I had a my time at Hortonworks and Cloudera, I was on a Mac for the first time in during my time there as my work machine. It was fine, but I didn't love it. And I'm now back to
Yeah,
Linux on the
same
desktop
thing.
as well, and back to loving it. So I don't
It's all true,
know.
but
I'm
it's all
weird.
about selecting the best tool for the job. I mean, I've got my Mac laptop from work, I've got my Windows desktop for my daily driver, and I've got my two Linux servers there for anything that is more than browsing the web and reading PowerPoint presentations. Basically, use what it's good for, and not, I mean, Steam is built, just to take your example further on, it's built for Windows. It'll always be run better on Windows than anywhere else, up until the point that the year of the Linux desktop actually arrives. But that's never going to happen because there is the gravitas of usage of the Linux environment is not reading Word documents or building PowerPoint presentations. The people who do that aren't the people that even know Linux exists, although they probably know Linux exists these days because the company does use it. And that's another thing. I mean, Linux begins enterprise desktop rollouts. That's been there for a while already. That has been there for some, again, for some users in an organization, Linux is the best tool. A lot of developers use Linux desktops because they like the VI stuff. If they deploy, if they work in Java applications, it's one of the better solutions to do that stuff. So it's not new, but if he means that the CEO's assistant is going to start working on a Linux desktop, well, maybe if it works for Red Hat.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't really.
Well, even Red Hat has, there's a lot of Mac usage there nowadays. Very different to when I was there. But one thing I will call out, because I think they do not get enough renown, is in the article he talks about like Linux Enterprise desktop rollouts. He calls out the two big players, Lenovo and Dell, for obvious reasons. But one other one that he calls out is System 76. And I really admire System 76. I had the chance to work with them in a professional capacity, and I cannot say enough nice things about them as an organization that that sort of, you know, really truly believes in open source. They produce some very nice hardware, all of which is running Linux. They've even developed like their own desktop interface and called Pop OS.
They've got Pop. Okay, that's where I know them from.
And like they're just a really nice bunch of people with some great products, really well engineered. And they even go that extra mile of, you know, developing open firmware. So you can actually go to the GitHub repo. You can take a look at the firmware for your device as well. You can modify it. You can flash new versions of it up. Like it's, they're a wonderful organization. I wish them all the success. And I hope that they are part of this. But realistically, I'm not sure that I really believe that 2021 will be the year of Linux on the desktop, but there we go.
No. Just so everybody knows, because we're on YouTube now, we have to say this, we are not being sponsored by System 76 at all. We didn't get any money to say this. It's just Dave talking about his own background.
Very true.
Experiences, right?
Very true.
This is not a paid advertisement, so we don't get any paid advertisement at all. So this is just informative.
Yeah, indeed. Just my opinions and my experiences. So yeah, that's our friend, our fabulous friend Jack and his predictions for 2021. I'd love the audience's comments on this and your predictions. let us know what you think. But yeah, anything else on prediction side of things, Jon?
No, I was just thinking if there's anything I would like to add to the list, but as I said earlier, it's such a volatile period at the moment that, and of course we're also recording this before it goes live, that's just how physics works.
And time, don't forget time.
well, time is physics, physics is time, so it's the same thing. That's easy. It's the unified theory of strings and whatever.
Strings and sticky back plastic. The unified theory of that. Yeah. No. Okay. All right. Let's
the one thing I'm missing in his list though is cloud. He hasn't anything that really touches upon cloud, and I do think cloud will definitely not relent. It'll be even more cloud. He has fog, but I think it's going to be more cloud than fog.
Fair enough. All right. Let's get on to our last article for the episode. Let's talk about terminals. Yay!
I had to reread the title twice. I mean, terminal velocity, vitality, sorry. I'm assuming that's the play on words he's doing
there. I believe so. I love this article for lots of different reasons. Like the very first intro to it, Douglas, ever since Douglas Engelbart flipped over a trackball and discovered a mouse. Like, that's just amazing. I love
it. He should clean his desk more often.
Yeah, he should. He should. I think what he actually means is he discovered the concept of a mouse. But it's like, this is obviously, it's not talking about things ending. It's about the terminal interface and the fact that, despite the fact that sort of computers really, you know, started off, they didn't start off with this kind of interface. Let's face it, they started off with, you know, glowing tubes and, you know, punch cards, and before that, you know, cogs and all sorts. But the terminal interface is an interface that for computers that's been around for a very long time. But exactly as you were saying earlier, it's still incredibly relevant today. It's had amazing staying power.
Yeah, I need the introduction. What kind of hit me there is he said, our interactions with computers have shifted from linguistics to hieroglyphics. We're actually going backwards.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's so much faster just type a command and do this, especially in the GUIs that have a tendency to require to change every release to make sure that you have a reason to buy it. So let's put this button on the left instead of the right. Remove this good old control panel. Yes, Microsoft is removing the control panel in the next version of Windows even more. Why change stuff? I mean, I know where it is. I can blindly go control panel, click, add a user, whatever, find devices. Now I have to go to the newfangled stuff. It takes more time. It's not useful. And that's actually coming back to your point about Apple Macs. That's why I don't like Macs that much. When I use a Mac, the first thing I do is open a terminal window, and I don't care about macOS. And I just hate the limitations of BSD because I want to have the Linux freedom.
Yeah. I don't know. I love so much about this. As I said, like things like there's a section in here that's talking about the efficiency of, like, the terminal's always focused on efficiency. And it's talking about back in 1971, when you were looking at, you know, 110 baud, you know, modem connections, you know, shortening the word copy to the command CP and the command list to LS. There you go. You've just doubled your efficiency. Congratulations. Shortening concatenate.
Every bit was a penny.
Like, just it really does make a huge difference. But what what that blends into, and it's been like the Unix philosophy in many ways, is having lots of small individual commands that themselves are powerful, but when you use them together, like they can do amazing and even more complicated things. So I've always...
It's a microservices OS?
Yeah, exactly. Microservices at an OS level. But it sort of, you know, the article continues to talk about Bash and the history and how that works. And like there are a number of things that I know I could automate, but I do them so infrequently that actually pulling up a command from my history and like repeating it like three times with a couple of different arguments is just, it's so easy. I barely even think about it. And I love that about the shell and the terminal interface. It's sort of one of those things that, you know, I regularly mention whenever the topic comes up, I'm a terrible developer. I can read code. I can hack at other people's code if I'm given a bit of guidance, and I can knock together a bash script here or there, but I'm still awful at it. I continue to be awful at it, and I try to avoid it whenever possible. But I really do appreciate the amazing things that people are able to do with just, you know, a handful of lines of bash, and it's, or any shell, like it's, and it's still pretty readable for the most part. So,
and very important for me is it it works across that modem. Because even though the baud rates have gone up a bit, starting up a X Windows terminal session, or even worse, a remote desktop Windows session on a remote computer to work on it,
yep,
that's a pain in the bee. I don't want to do that. Just an SSH and I can start getting my history up and down. That works so much more easy. Now, I do agree that with IPMI having their web interfaces and getting that made sense. But again, with the ultimate hope of achieving that remote console window.
Yep.
Because again, the screenshot he had in his article here, this is the best use of a GUI. Just be able to have multiple bash shells side by side. And if you look at a lot of people that are working on a technology level, this is what the desktop looks like.
Yeah. Yeah.
That and Steam.
I love tiling window managers, but I cannot quite make the... I haven't quite been able to make the switch. I'm still a little bit too stuck in the land of the GUI and the drag and drop and that side of things. My screen does look a lot like that in certain like viewports or desktops, whatever you want to call them. But I also, you know, have a similar layout with that I like to drag and drop around depending on what I'm doing at any given time. So
that's the one thing that's missing on the desktop there is a browser, because you need a source to cut and paste from.
I'm sure that's on his other viewport, his other desktop, his other worktop. But I think this article has a little bit for everything, for everybody. And I just can't see the command line going away anytime soon. Like, despite the fact that we sort of continue to, as you were saying earlier, like simplify things and kind of get to the point where things are more and more easy for organizations and people to consume, there will still be that sort of that connection that you want to understand something, you want to dig into something a little bit deeper, you want to understand what's going on, you want to, you know, run things, you want to do things in a way that the terminal just makes it easy to do.
Again, proper tool for the proper job.
Agreed.
If you want to put a kiosk somewhere to people to buy a train ticket, iconography is great for that. It's multi-language, it's accessible, big buttons you can punch, great. If you're a hacker or a developer or a DevOps engineer or a machine learning engineer trying to write a script, I mean, there are these drag and drop script building things where you can drag a for next loop and then drag your... God, no.
Yeah.
Just no. Just
yeah.
No. Just
no. I now can't get the idea out of my mind of like being at a train station and being like all these ticket machines that have the ordinary like screens on where you like pick where you're going from and pick where you're going through, and then just one with like a full keyboard and like a flashing command prompt you just got to go to, and like a bit like an adventure game, you've got to type help and like it prints out the commands that you can order ticket from colon the short code, like, you know, source and destination station. And then, you know, I put a flag in for whether you're, in a super saver ticket or, and then hit return. And then you just put your credit card in or tap your card against it and hope that you got all the flags correct.
Yeah. And just don't go sit anywhere because you're so unsure, you don't want to get a fine. So you just stand up straight anyway.
Yep. I love that idea. I think that would be awesome.
Final shout out for me on this article is Screen.
Yes.
Nobody talks about Screen. I'm sure everybody uses it. If you don't know Screen, learn it, love it, enjoy it. It's made a huge difference in my life. Actually, I've replaced on almost all of my servers the login shell by the Screen command.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. That makes quite often I'm doing something on the remote service and for some reason connection gets lost.
Mm.
And if you were doing an RPM install at that point,
yeah, that's not good.
You're kind of in the deep shit at that point, having that screen thing running.
Mm.
And I know if I do it manually, I'll forget it.
Yeah.
So just having that in my login cell, I just connect again and it's still going.
Yep. So for those that are looking into this for the first time, the other one that I see a lot is TMUX. In fact, I would probably say I see TMUX more nowadays than I see screen. But yeah, both of them, amazing time savers, life savers. If you spend time on the console, connected remotely to anything, take a look at either or both of them and decide what's best for you. But yeah.
Yeah, TMUX is too complicated. It's I'm too simple for TMUX. Screen is all I need.
TMUX is for power users, which is why I'm also a screen user. fantastic. All right. Well, with that, unless there's anything else from you.
Nope, I've got my shout out for screen, and it was a glorious moment just... Yeah, looking back at the good old Bash shell, the born again shell.
Fair enough.
Should be religion for that.
Fair enough. All right. Well, in that case, then realistically, that is all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast by becoming a Patreon. Every contribution really does help. We are on YouTube. You can like, you can subscribe, you can comment even. You can ring the notification bell and you can do all the YouTube things. As Jan often says, it really does make me happy. So please do. You can also go to www.roaringelephant.org for a link to our Patreon page and for more information about the podcast. You can follow us on Twitter using the @roaringelephant tag. And you can send your feedback if you like some old school email to podcast@roaringelephant.org. Until next time, my name is, let's see, I could be Bash Dave, but that sounds quite violent.
Some Dave bashing. I like it.
I thought you would.
My name is, I've been joining this already, Jan, so I don't have to do anything more.
And we look forward to talking to you next week.
Goodbye.
See you then.